sinner he giveth travail, to gather up, to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. So, in other words, a man can gather up and heap up his goods if he wants to, but God will give it to the person that he sees fit to give it to. And so you have no control over the situation. It's all emptiness. It's all chasing after the wind. Going on to chapter 3, we come to a well-known passage made popular by the bird song, Turn, Turn, Turn. They didn't write it first. Solomon did. And the purpose of it was not to give us a lovely piece of poetry to sing about, but basically to show the endless cycle of things. And what he's essentially saying is there are no absolutes. How frustrating. There's nothing solid that's unchangeable, that always stays the same, that you can lay your hand on. He's saying everything has its time. Some things are right one time and wrong another time. It's sort of a situation ethics. There's a time when it's right to kill. There's a time when it's right to heal. There's a time when it's right to mourn. There's a time when it's right to dance. Now, what he's saying is there's no consistency in life. Everything has its time, and there's just nothing solid that you can lay your hand on and say, this is an absolute. And that's what he's complaining about here. This is a complaint, not just a beautiful poem. To everything there is a season, meaning there's a time for everything, and a time to every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, and then there's a time you have to gather them all up again. There's a time to embrace and there's a time when it's not right to embrace, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep, and there's a time to throw away things, not keep them. A time to tear, rend, and a time to sow or to mend. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? What profit is there in laboring for any cause when that cause you're laboring good now but won't be good tomorrow? What if you're laboring for war and then as soon as you're finished doing it, you find out it's not time for war? War is inappropriate. There's a time for war, there's a time for peace. Well, what if I spend all my time making peace? Well, then my effort is wasted if the time of war comes. If a time for war, where war is the right thing, he's saying. So you never know if you're working for a cause that's going to be always right. Some causes are right at one time and the opposite cause is right at another time. And he's saying this is futility. There's no profit in our works because of that. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work of God, that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Now, that verse requires some comment. When it says he has made everything beautiful in his time, there's a worship song that's been made from that misunderstands the meaning here. It's not saying that in God's time he'll turn everything out to be beautiful. You know, everything that's bad, he'll make it right in his time. The word his there really should be translated its time. Everything at its appropriate time is beautiful. Sometimes killing is beautiful. Sometimes healing is beautiful. Sometimes building walls is beautiful. Sometimes tearing down walls is beautiful. Everything has its own time, where it has its own peculiar kind of rightness and beauty to it. And that's not always true. There is not a time to love and a time to hate. And in Christ there is not a time for peace and a time for war. There's only a time for peace. Of course there is an aspect of war, warfare against the demons, but again, it's not as though one thing is right one time, but later, because circumstances are different, the same thing is wrong. It's not a situation ethics world in God's eyes. But under the sun, man under the sun can come to nothing higher than this in his philosophy. Now when it says in the middle of verse 11, he also hath set the world in their heart, the Revised Version says he has set eternity in their heart, which is actually a better translation the literal meaning of the word that is here translated the world, to translate the Hebrew word literally would be the vanishing point, not the world, but the vanishing point, perhaps the horizon, where you can see no further. That's what the word actually means, and so it means probably eternity, that beyond which we can see, you know, that which extends beyond the point we can see, beyond the vanishing point. And what it's saying then is that God has put in man's heart a quest for the eternal. He has put eternity in man's heart. There's a book by that name, Eternity in Their Hearts, which is showing that every tribe of, under the sun has had this quest for the true God. And so also here, what he's saying is that God has made man so he can't be satisfied with the world. He can't be satisfied under the sun. It's too limited. Man is too big for this world. Man has a heart that is filled with eternity, and the world is too small to bring satisfaction to an eternal hunger. To quench an eternal hunger requires an eternal supply, an eternal satisfaction that comes from God. So it says, so that a man cannot find out God's works that he does from the beginning to the end. Going on, verse 12. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor, it is the gift of God. Again, the same conclusion he had in chapter 2, verse 24. Nothing better than just to eat and drink and enjoy whatever it is God's given you. No reference there to fearing God or keeping his commandments, because that is a conclusion he arose at later in life. He's at this point still telling us how he used to reason. This is what he used to think when he was chasing after fulfillment under the sun. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fear before him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. And God requireth that which is past. And moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment. Now this is in the place of government. He's going to say, I saw corruption in the government. This is very depressing. So I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there. And the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in mine heart, concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, that they might see that they themselves are beasts. And that which befalls the sons of men befalls beasts also. Even one thing befalls them, meaning death. As one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is emptiness. All go to one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to the dust again. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward? Actually, a modern translation, I think, changes that to, who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward or not? And the spirit of the beast that goes downward. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? So the third time now he mentions his conclusion. There's nothing better than just to eat and drink, enjoy the things you have. That's worldly counsel. That's what a lot of worldly people think. Man, you just better enjoy it while you can. That's the best you can do. That's not what the Bible says in other places, but that's the way some worldly people muse. And the conclusion you're driven to if you're not taking God into consideration in your worldview. Okay, now, he says that animals and men are no better off than each other. The spirit or the breath of man is no different than the breath of animals. He's pointing out that just like an animal dies, so does a man die. And later on, in chapter 9, he tells us that the dead don't know anything at all. These verses are sometimes used by groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses and others who believe that there is no consciousness beyond death. Who believe that when you die, you're dead or you're asleep and you don't have any knowledge of what's going on. They use these verses from Ecclesiastes to prove their point. But as you can see, Ecclesiastes, especially the first 10 chapters, are not a very good place to start deriving doctrine from. If you're going to let a backslidden man determine your doctrines for you, you're going to have a pretty strange doctrinal position, especially since Solomon changed his mind even within the same period of time in his backsliddenness about some of these things. For example, where he in one place said that women can't be trusted, in another place he says you should enjoy a good wife in chapter 9 and verse 9. So he's suggesting that there is such a thing as trusting a woman. Whereas he says in some places the spirit of the animals and the spirit of the man is no different, they both go to the grave. Yet in chapter 12 and verse 7 he says that the man's spirit goes up to God when he dies. That the spirit goes back to him that made him. So Solomon doesn't even always say the same thing. When he was backslidden, he mused over various philosophical possibilities. And he shares with us what some of them were. Some of them contradict each other. And it's not really a very wise thing for a denomination or a religious group to take a verse from Ecclesiastes, especially from that portion where Solomon is just recounting the things he thought when he was backslidden, and make a doctrine about that, because Solomon was not taking into consideration things over the sun. It may be true that under the sun, man and beast both go back to the dust and don't seem to have any, one doesn't seem to have preeminence over the other. But in the sun, in Christ, in the revelation we receive from God, we know that man is higher than the beast and is made in the image of God and is made to live forever after he dies. Okay, let's go on to chapter 4. So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are under the sun, that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such as were oppressed. And they had no comforter, and on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. So he's getting real depressed when he sees how the oppressed are oppressed, and the people who oppress them have money and power and influence, and there's just no stopping this oppression. Perhaps in his own kingdom he could have some influence, but he was as much an oppressor as anywhere. He was an oppressive king. He just figured, I guess it's just inevitable. The rich are going to oppress the poor, so he just did it. He said, wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they which hath not yet been, who hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Now that wording is difficult, but what he's saying is he that has not yet been born is better off than both the people mentioned in verse 2, the dead and those who are still alive waiting to die. The man who was never born is better off than the man who's still alive or the man who's already died. Because the man who's never been has never experienced grief yet. And he has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. The fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. Meaning he's lazy, he folds his hands instead of working with them and ends up eating. He has nothing to eat, he might as well eat himself. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full with travail and vexation and striving after the wind. It's better to be content with just one handful, in other words, what you need, just what you need, rather than try to get twice as much as you need, but have to spend your whole time striving to get it and travailing. Then I returned and saw the vanity under the sun. There is one alone, and there is not a second. Yea, he hath neither child nor brother. Yet is there no end of all his labor. Neither is his eye satisfied with riches. Neither saith he, for whom do I labor and bereave my soul of good? This is also vanity. Yea, it is sore travail. What he's saying is, he's seen people who don't even stop to think about why they're working so hard. People who don't have any descendants to leave it to. They don't have any child. They don't have a brother. They don't have anyone to give it to. But they just keep working and working and working just to get richer. They don't think, you know, well, what's going to happen to it when you die? He said, it's emptiness, empty toil. Two are better than one. This is a well-known scripture. And basically what he's saying here is that it's better to have someone with you than to be alone. It's lonely out there without the Lord. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe unto him who is alone when he falls. For he hath not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone? And if one prevail against him, who shall withstand? Two shall withstand him, and the threefold cord is not quickly broken. Now we can apply this spiritually to fellowship too, because what's true in the natural is true in the spiritual here also. In the natural, it's true. You're better off if you happen to fall into a ditch, if you have a friend with you to pull you out. It's warmer sleeping with two people in a bed than with one. And if one person is attacked in a dark alley, if he has a friend there, it's much more likely they'll be able to prevail against him. And if there's a third, it's even better. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. It means a cord that is made with three strands woven together is very strong. And so also three friends who are committed to each other and woven together are very strong. These scriptures are sometimes quoted at weddings about how it's better to be married. Did they quote that at your wedding? You're looking at each other knowingly. That it's better to have a partner than to not have a partner. And there needs to be a third partner. There has to be a threefold cord in order for there to be no breaking of the relationship. And that, of course, would be Jesus. It would be the third party in a Christian marriage. And a threefold cord then would not be quickly broken. Better is a poor man and a wise... Oh, I'm sorry. Better is a poor and a wise child than an old and foolish king who will no more be admonished or isn't teachable anymore. Perhaps thinking of himself. For out of prison he cometh to reign, that is, the wise child does, whereas he that is born in his kingdom becometh poor. Now what he's saying is there's two people he's talking about. One is a poor and wise child. That child's destiny is to come out of prison and to reign. But the old foolish king who won't be instructed anymore, all his subjects will become poor. This was literally true. And Solomon perhaps was even prophesying this as he thought about this, because he was an old foolish king who wouldn't receive instruction anymore. He departed from the ways of God. And his kingdom became poor. In fact, when Solomon became king, the kingdom was at its richest point. David left the kingdom to his son Solomon at a very rich and opulent place. But when Solomon died, the kingdom was impoverished because he spent so much on his houses that he built that he mentioned and all. The temple and so many other things, his armies and his servants and his food for his table. He spent so much money, talk about government waste, the guy ran the whole country from its most opulent and prosperous time down to its lowest point financially. And so his subjects did become poor because he was unteachable. However, the wise and poor child who comes from prison to reign speaks almost prophetically of Jeroboam. Because Solomon's son Rehoboam lost the kingdom to a man named Jeroboam. Jeroboam came to reign over 10 tribes. Jeroboam, in Solomon's days, had been banished because he was a danger to Solomon politically. And so Solomon banished Jeroboam, and I think Jeroboam went to Egypt, if I'm not mistaken. And then when Solomon died and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, came up, Jeroboam came back and won the approval of 10 tribes. And so it's like he came from prison to reign. And the wise old king, who had become so foolish by not being teachable, his subjects became poor, and the poor wise person came out of prison and reigned. So what he's saying is wisdom will do more for a man though he's poor, even if he's a prisoner. With wisdom, he can do more than a king who's got all kinds of privilege and opportunity, but is foolish and won't be instructed. Wisdom is the deciding factor between the two. Verse 15. I considered all the living which walk under the sun, with the second child that shall stand up in his stead. There is no end of all the people, even of all that have been before them. They also that come after shall not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and vexation of spirit. So no matter which of those two is reigning, after they die, no one will remember them or rejoice in their memory at all. Chapter 5, keep thy foot when thou goest into the house of God. Now we get into some practical instruction, some of which is decent. Basically, looking back, telling his story, he lapses occasionally into places where he gives some advice. His advice often is coming from the place of his repentant position, so that he gives some good advice based on the mistakes he made. Here's some advice that is good. Keep your foot when you go into the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth. Don't speak too hastily or too quickly. And let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and you are upon the earth. Therefore let your words be few. For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by the multitude of words. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, don't delay, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have owed, what you have vowed. Better it is that thou shouldest not make a vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. Don't permit your mouth to cause you to sin. Neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Excuse me. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thine hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words there are also diverse emptinesses, but you fear God. Okay, so that's good advice. Now what he's saying here is, when you go into the temple, don't offer the sacrifice of fools. What that means is, don't vow to give God something, to make some sacrifice that is foolishly unrealistic. Because it's better for you not to make such a vow than to make the vow and later not be able to pay it. Now, why would people vow to do something for God that they wouldn't really intend to do it? Well, no doubt because they wanted to appear religious. All the other people around were making great promises to God, so they make a great promise to God too. I'll vow to give 10 cows at the next sacrifice, you know. He makes a vow because everyone around thinks he's real religious then. But he doesn't really intend to do it. He's just trying to measure up to everyone else. But he doesn't realize that he's sinning with his lips because he's vowing before God. He'd be better off if he'd never spoken a vow at all than to offer up a vow to God and not pay it, because God will require it of him. Furthermore, he says in verse 3, for a dream comes through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by the multitude of his words. The more a man speaks, the more foolish he'll show himself to be. And this is speaking particularly in this case of speaking too quickly vows, making too many promises to God. The more he talks, the more he's shown to be a dreamer. He's not speaking realistically. The multitude of his activities and of his words just tend toward being in a dream world and not being in touch with reality. And he shows himself to be a fool by how many promises he makes. And it says also in verse 7, for the multitude of dreams and many words there are also various emptinesses. But you should just fear God. Fear God and don't offer vows too hastily. Jesus said the same thing, by the way. Jesus said, don't vow at all. Don't swear by heaven, don't swear by the earth, don't swear by your own head. And James, in his epistle in chapter 5, concluded his epistle with a similar exhortation. He says, but above all things, my brethren, swear not at all, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea and your nay, nay. So James, in recalling the Sermon on the Mount, put that above all. He said, but above all things, don't swear. So the idea is, don't make commitments to God that you don't intend to keep. Because if you don't keep them, you're still responsible for them. Your words, you'll be judged by the words of your mouth. Jesus said, a man will be judged, every idle word that comes out of a man's mouth will he be having to give an account for in the day of judgment. So make sure we're careful about how we speak and don't say things we don't mean. Verse 8, if you see the oppression of the poor and violence perverting the judgment and justice in the province, marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Now here's a striking and refreshing note of optimism here. He's saying essentially, if you see oppression, don't get too depressed. Now, it's not saying you shouldn't do anything about it. It's just saying don't get too depressed and pessimistic. Because there is a God in heaven who judges all men, and he is above them and he's superior and sovereign. He will have his way ultimately, in spite of the oppressors. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver. There's another vanity. Nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. The more you get, the more people there are to take it from you. In other words, you increase your crops, and you're going to have more people coming around to eat at your table. You're not going to get ahead. He says, and what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? You only get to see them go. You get to see them long enough to see the other people eat them. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. He's rich, he doesn't have any peace of mind. He's always afraid he'll be robbed. He has to stay awake. He can't sleep well because he's too rich. He's too protective of what he has. But the laboring man, whether he's rich or poor, sleeps well. He sleeps well because he's tired from working, and he also, he's not afraid of a little work. If he gets ripped off for what he has, he can always work for more. He's not a lazy rich man who just inherited it all and has to protect it for fear that he'd lose it and never be able to regain it. But those riches perish by evil travail, and he begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. As he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return, and to go as he came. That's what Paul also said, of course, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, that we came into this world without anything, and we can't take anything out with us. And of course, Job said the same thing, naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. So also says Solomon. And this also is a sore evil, that in all points, as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he when he hath labored for the wind? All his days also he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. Now here's his final conclusion again, that he always comes back to. Behold, that which I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor, that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God, for he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. Okay, let's go on down into the next chapter. It's a short one. It says, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. It's not just something I've seen. It's common knowledge that this thing is true. A man to whom God hath given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all that he desireth, yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eateth it. This is vanity, and it is an evil disease. Again, you work hard and get something, and God blesses you with wealth, but you can't eat it all. A millionaire, or these multimillionaires, could never use all their money. They don't intend to. They just plan to reinvest it and get richer and richer and richer, but they'll never get any benefit out of it. Someone else is going to come along and use it someday, probably the IRS, when they die. If a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that his days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. It's better to have been miscarried or to be aborted before being born than to have been born and not and to die childless with nothing, no one to leave your things to. For he cometh in with emptiness and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun nor known anything, but hath one rest, or hath more rest than the other. That is, the person who died before he was born, a miscarried baby, is better off, because he's never seen the sun, he's never seen sorrow. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. The more he labors, ahead of myself, verse 6. Yea, though he live 1,000 years twice told, yet hath he seen no good. Do not all go to one place? All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. For what hath the wise more than the fool? What hath the poor that knoweth to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. That it's better to just be happy with what you can see before you and have before you than to let your desires run wild and to get covetous. This also is emptiness and striving after the wind. That which hath been is named already, and it is known that it is man. Neither may he contend with him that is mightier than he. Seeing there be many things that increase vanity, what is man the better? For who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life, which he spendeth as a shadow? For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? Okay, we have time to go on into the seventh chapter now, and then we'll take our break. As Proverbs chapter 22:1 says, a good name is more to be desired than great riches. Here he says, a good name is better than precious ointment. And the day of death is better than the day of one's birth. That's a pessimist for you. Cynical. It's better to be dead than to be born. It is better to go to the house of mourning, which means to a funeral, than to the house of feasting, which would be a party. For that is the latter end of all men, meaning that death is. You're wiser to go to a funeral than to be in parties all the time. If you go to funerals, at least you'll be reminded that you're going to die. And that'll keep you sober. But if you go out and party all the time, you're going to forget that you're going to die, and you won't be thinking about real valuable things. You won't be thinking about eternity. So it's better to go to the house of mourning, which is a funeral, than go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Meaning if a person goes to a funeral, he'll think about death. And he'll remember that he too will go that way someday. And it may cause him to behave more wisely than otherwise. Sorrow is better than laughter. For by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. But the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. Now the rebuke of the wise means that though rebuke is unpleasant, if it comes from the wise man, it'll do you a lot more good than being in a party and hearing fools singing. Singing may be more pleasant than rebukes, but you'll gain more by the rebukes of a wise man than by the songs of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. This also is vanity. So the fools laughing at the parties and having a good time, it's like the sound of thorns crackling under the pot. And the interesting thing is, he's no doubt speaking of a pot that's on the fire, and the thorns are the fuel for the fire. They're crackling with the fire. The fire is crackling its thorns and its fuel, the sticks and such that are gathered to burn under the cauldron. So it's saying essentially that when you hear a fool laughing, it's clear that he's not taking into consideration that he's burning up, that he's on the path to destruction. It's like the sound of a fire burning up its victim, its thorns that are used for fuel. This is vanity. Surely the oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift, meaning a bribe, destroys the heart. Now, meaning a wise ruler who oppresses people will become a madman. And a man who takes bribes will ruin his heart. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. The former days weren't any better than these days. The good old days weren't so good when they were here. They're just good now because we remember them fondly. But they weren't any better. You're not wise to even be thinking along those lines. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. For wisdom is a defense, and money is a defense. But the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider, God also hath set one over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him. God, and what it's saying is, if you're in prosperity, rejoice in it, because the day is going to come where you're in adversity. And consider that that's just what God does. He gives people both, so that they get, eventually they don't take anything with them. They're rich for a while, but then they come into adversity, and their riches won't spare them. So that afterward the man will find nothing to save him. All things have I seen in the days of my vanity. That's in his days of backsliddenness. There is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongs his life in wickedness. Now in the Proverbs, Solomon had said that if you live in wisdom, it'll prolong your days. You'll live a long life. But he's saying there are exceptions. I have seen righteous people who are short-lived. I've seen wicked people who seem to never die. Be not righteous too much, was his conclusion as a backslider. Don't be too righteous. Don't be too religious. Don't be a fanatic. Why knock yourself out? Don't make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? On the other hand, don't be too wicked either. Don't be too foolish. Why should you die before your time? Just be a middle-of-the-road kind of person. Don't be too good or too bad. That's obviously the counsel of a worldly person, not of a Christian. Be not too much wicked. Okay, we read that. Verse 18. It is good that thou shouldest take hold of this. Yea, also from this withdraw not thine hand. For he that feareth God shall come forth of them all. Wisdom strengtheneth the wise more than 10 mighty men which are in a city. For there is not a just man upon the earth that doeth good and sinneth not. That's a rather cynical position to take. But perhaps in his day that was true. Jesus, however, was a just man who didn't sin, and the Bible says that we're supposed to live that way too. Also take no heed unto all words that are spoken, lest thou hear thy servant curse thee. In other words, don't be too curious. Whenever there's people conversing, don't always want to eavesdrop. You might hear something that doesn't bless you. Oops, that's my servant cursing me. I wish I hadn't heard that. I was too nosy. Don't be too nosy. You might hear something that's not good for you to hear. It says, for oftentimes also thine own heart knoweth that you yourself likewise has cursed others. All this have I proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? I applied mine heart to know, and to search, and to seek out wisdom, and the reason of things, and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, and her hands as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account, which yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. Now what's he saying there? What he's saying is, among a thousand men, he only finds maybe one that stands out. Only one that's even worth anything more than the others. However, in a thousand women, he doesn't find any that stand out. They're all alike, he says. Now, it's interesting that the number 1,000 would come up, because that's how many women he had. He said in all his women, in 1,000 women, he didn't find any exceptional one. Now, however, he did write the Song of Solomon, so there must have been 1,001 women in his life. One of them he did feel pretty good about. And he said some good things about women in the book of Proverbs, but when he got older, he realized, no doubt, that the women that he had married had turned his heart away from God. Therefore, he saw them as enemies rather than lovers. And he said that, I haven't found a good one among them. And among men, it's not much better. He said, I find maybe 1 in 1,000 that are any good. He himself wasn't all that good. Verse 29, Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. What's that mean? It means that when God made man, he made him good. Any complications, any evils that have come have been sought out by man himself. God can't be blamed for all the trouble in the earth. One translation says, I think, God made man's life simple. All the complexities are of man's own making. And that's one way that reads. Okay, we'll take our break now.